tonight on PBS News Weekend. Why some of the top colleges and universities in America are opting out of a decades-old rankings list. Then, with infections on the rise, what you need to know about ticks and the spread of Lyme disease this summer. And how anonymity on social media influences the way people act online, including harassment.
It was just really disheartening knowing that the bubble that people felt, that it was safe, that this is not that type of place, is actually not true.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. Former President Donald Trump was on the campaign trail today, stumping for votes a day after an indictment was unsealed detailing 37 felony counts against him, all stemming from his handling of classified documents after leaving the White House. At the Georgia Republican Convention in Columbus this afternoon, Trump lashed out at the Justice Department and the special prosecutor who led the investigation.
The ridiculous and baseless indictment of me by the Biden administration's weaponized Department of Injustice will go down as among the most horrific abuses of power in the history of our country. And we have a thug who's in charge. This is a political hit job. Republicans are treated far differently at the Justice Department than Democrats.
Earlier at the North Carolina Republican Convention in Greensboro, rival candidate Mike Pence, who's been cleared by an investigation of his handling of classified documents, defended his former boss.
Former president, like every other American, is entitled to a presumption of innocence. Attorney General Merrick Garland, stop hiding behind the special counsel and stand before the American people and explain why this indictment went forward.
Trump is to make his initial appearance in federal court in Miami on Tuesday. Between this week's indictment in Florida and a March indictment in New York, the former president is facing 71 felony counts. Theodore Kaczynski, the man known as the Unabomber, has died. Between 1978 and 1995, he used homemade bombs in a one-man effort to try to bring down modern society. Theodore Kaczynski was one of America's most notorious domestic terrorists. For nearly 20 years, the Harvard-trained mathematician made untraceable bombs in a shack he built himself in rural Montana. He mailed or hand-delivered them to unsuspecting targets. The FBI branded him the Unabomber because his early attacks were against universities and airlines. In 1995, Kaczynski sent the Washington Post and the New York Times a 35,000-word manifesto outlining his disdain for modern society and technology. He said his deadly crusade would continue if the outlets refused to publish it. In the end, it led to his arrest. After reading it, Kaczynski's brother and sister-in-law tipped off authorities. In April 1996, the FBI captured Kaczynski in his shack, which was filled with journals, explosive materials, and completed bombs. Kaczynski pleaded guilty to a variety of charges and was given four life sentences plus 30 years in prison. Kaczynski was 81 when he died today in a federal medical facility in North Carolina. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his long-awaited military counteroffensive against Russia has begun. At a news conference in Kyiv with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Zelensky would not elaborate on Ukraine's progress so far. Trudeau pledged $500 million in new military aid to support the war effort. On the front lines, fighting has intensified in the south and the east. The Ukrainian army claims they've made progress in the fight to reclaim the eastern city of Bakhmut. This after Russian video appeared to show recent airstrikes on Ukrainian armored vehicles. The fighting has forced the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant to shut down its last reactor. Much of the surrounding area is still reeling from a major dam rupture and massive flooding earlier in the week. Shifting weather patterns are helping clear the skies over the East Coast. Those skies had been fouled by smoke from Canada's worst wildfire season on record. A cold front is expected to push the smoke out into the sea early next week. Skies over Manhattan, which had been a hazy orange for much of the week, were clear today. At the White House, crowds gathered this afternoon for a Pride Month celebration. Poor air quality forced a postponement earlier in the week. And in the Amazon jungle, a miraculous rescue. Four indigenous children, ranging in age from 13 years to 11 months, were found alive after being stranded for 40 days. They had survived a plane crash. The Colombian Army airlifted the siblings out of the wilderness on Friday. They're now getting medical treatment in Bogota. The crash of the light aircraft killed their mother and two pilots. President Gustavo Petro says the children were found by a rescue dog. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, as the summer tick season gets started, what you need to know to stay safe, and how anonymity on social media influences the way people act online.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
For decades, U.S. News and World Report has been ranking colleges and universities. And for decades, colleges and universities have been complaining about the guide's outsized influence and the criteria it uses. This week, Columbia University said it would no longer provide information for the rankings, the highest profile dropout from the undergraduate ratings. This follows a parade of prestigious law schools and medical schools that said they'd no longer participate in the graduate school rankings. Francie Deep is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, covering money in higher education. Francie, when Columbia announced this, the step they were taking, they said they had concerns about how the rankings distill a university's profile into a composite of data categories. Numbers alone could never convey the broader experience of undergraduate life at Columbia. Is that sort of the nub, the gist of their arguments against the rankings?
Yeah, I'd say so. That's a big deal for both Columbia and other colleges that have complained about the rankings. I would say another big thing for colleges is they feel that the rankings create sort of perverse incentives. So, for example, the law schools you mentioned, they dropped out. A number of them decided not to cooperate with U.S. News. And one of their complaints was that the rankings formula depends a lot on the employment rates of graduates, which you can totally understand why you would want that in your rankings. You go to law school and you hope that you're employed afterward. But some of the law schools that left U.S. News complained that fellowships did not count as employment. And they were saying, like, a lot of these fellowships funded by the schools themselves prepared students to go into public interest law. And so you can see how not counting fellowships as employment then might encourage law schools to offer fewer of these fellowships, maybe encourage students not to go to public interest law so much. Anyway, so that's another big problem for colleges is the kinds of incentives that the formula can create.
And how does U.S. News respond to those criticisms or those complaints?
Yeah, they've always said, you know, that they provide important data to students, that they're a source of independent third-party ranking or an evaluation of colleges, that they don't encourage students to use the ranking number only, that they is supposed to be one of a lot of things that you look at as a student. And they've also said they will continue ranking those colleges that have supposedly dropped out. Like, they can still create a ranking even without the colleges cooperating.
Columbia, of course, is the highest profile school and a member of the Ivy League to drop out of these rankings. Do you think we're going to see a parade like we did with the law schools and medical schools?
Yeah, you know, it's really hard to know. As a reporter, I haven't heard of anything. But that said, if any schools are planning to do this, they'd probably keep it pretty tight-lipped. That said, the data survey that colleges was to turn into U.S. News, that's due in, like, weeks. So if colleges do have plans to boycott, we'll see that news come out pretty soon.
And I know you talked to high school students and high school guidance counselors to get a sense of how influential this guide is, these rankings are. And what did they tell you?
The one thing you worry about is that some prospective student is going to look only at the ranking and not think about other factors that might be important to them, including, like, you know, price of the college that might be important to them or certain programs. Anyway, when I talk to students, at least, you know, they all seem pretty savvy. They understood that rankings had flaws. They understood that they weren't supposed to look at only that. One kind of interesting thing I found was that the students that tended to rely the most on the rankings were actually sort of students who were ambitious. They could get into several good schools, but they didn't have a lot of, they weren't using their school counselors or the parents very much for guidance. They're kind of going at it on their own. Maybe their parents like hadn't gone to college in the US or hadn't gone to college at all. And so they're trying to figure things out on their own. You can totally see why something like a ranking would be really appealing to a student like that. Going into this story, I kind of expected that it might be sort of private school students, private prep school students, might be sort of especially concerned with prestige. But in fact, what I found was that those students go to schools where they have really savvy school counselors. They've been trying to like tell them for years, you know, you got to think about fit. You have to think about more than just the ranking. It's really the students with less guidance who, in my reporting at least, seem to rely more on the rankings.
How did U.S. News and World Report, sort of a general interest magazine, which also rates, I believe, cars, diets, and nursing homes, how did it become so influential in higher education?
Yeah, you know, that is a great question. They started ranking colleges pretty early. So, you know, they weren't the first. I don't think they were the absolute the first, but they've been doing it since the late 80s, came out with this best colleges list. So, you know, I think being one of the first probably helped them with their influence a lot. Another thing is that at the time that the rankings came out, you know, it was a time when more young Americans were going to college than ever. Over the past few decades, the number of young Americans going to higher ed had like tripled. So you're having a lot of students who, like the students that I talked to, maybe the first in their families to go to college, and are just looking for a way to evaluate and decide where to go. And this product really filled that need. And so its influence has only grown till today, although perhaps it's waning now that there's been sort of more of a public boycott.
Francie Deep of the Chronicle of Higher Education, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Summertime means more time outdoors, and that means more chances for tick bites and the risk of Lyme disease. According to the Centers for Disease Control, as many as 476,000 people in the United States contract Lyme disease every year. And climate change and our encroachment into wilderness areas means ticks and the Lyme disease-causing bacteria they can carry are more common in more places. Dr. Lyndon Hu is an immunology professor at Tufts University Medical School. He's also co-director of the Tufts Lyme Disease Initiative. Dr. Hu, what does Lyme disease do to us? What are the symptoms and how serious can it be?
Yeah, so Lyme disease typically enters into your body after the bite of a tick, and the bacteria cause a rash, usually right at the spot of the bite, and then spread rapidly from there to other skin sites, but can also get to the brain, can get to the heart, and can get to the joints, causing more severe disease.
How easily is it treated?
So for most people, antibiotics are pretty effective, especially if you get treated early. And there are a number of different antibiotics that work very well against Lyme disease. There are a small percentage of people, probably somewhere in the range of 10 to 15%, who will continue to have symptoms after treatment for Lyme disease.
And have ticks been spreading into more areas of the country? And why is that?
I think it's a combination of things. The ticks have spread a little bit, but they've always been there. The disease has spread into the ticks so that more ticks in more areas going up further north along the northeast shore and further south, again, along the Atlantic seaboard, are carrying Lyme disease now. And I think that's just the natural spread as more and more ticks get infected in an area and then continue to move outwards.
Any idea of why more ticks would become infected?
I think it has to do with the numbers of infected animals. So the ticks pick up the infection from mice and other small rodents, as well as birds. And as they spread, and they don't move very fast or very far geographically, as that gradually spreads and more infected mice spread down, you get more infected ticks in those areas.
It used to be you thought of this as something you got when you went hiking in the deep woods, but now is it prevalent in suburban areas as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, both the deer that are very important for the ticks, but don't carry Lyme disease, as well as the mice have become suburban creatures. And so they're living amongst us in the suburbs all the time. So there's more and more interaction between people and the ticks that are infected.
Does climate change play a role in any of this?
It's interesting. It's hard to predict exactly what climate change does. You know, the warmer weather certainly can mean that more mice and more deer survive the winter, which can mean more ticks and more infection. But it can also mean that when there are periods of drought, these ticks need moisture to survive during the summers. And if there's a long drought, you can actually see decrease. So it's variable what climate change could do to Lyme disease year to year.
Earlier, you said it's important that Lyme disease be treated early. Should anyone who gets a tick bite go to the doctor, or is there some warning sign that would trigger someone to go to the doctor?
Yeah, I think, you know, the funny thing with Lyme disease is that most people don't even know that they've been bitten by a tick. So certainly if you've been bitten by a tick, it's probably worth giving your doctor a call, because there are preventative medicines you can take if you take it within the first couple of days after you've been bitten. I think the key thing to look out for if you know that you've been bitten by a tick for Lyme disease is to watch for that erythema migrans rash.
And there are other tick-borne diseases. It's not just Lyme disease. There are other reasons why you should be wary of a tick bite.
Absolutely. And these ticks that carry Lyme disease also carry five other diseases. Most of those don't have anything as characteristic as the rash of Lyme disease. So what you have to be watching out for are fevers, chills, muscle aches, things like that that happen in the summer.
And talk about the research that's going on now. What are there? Are there potential new developments in prevention, in treatment? Is a vaccine possible?
Yeah, I think there have been advances, especially on the vaccine front, even in the last couple of years. So there is a human vaccine that is now in phase three trials, which is the final phase of trials before approval, that I think we're probably a couple of years off from. It's very similar to a previous vaccine that was approved and used in the U.S. maybe 20 years ago. But this is a new variation on that, and we're very hopeful that it'll have very similar effects without side effects. The other thing that just got approved last week is a vaccine for mice, actually. And there, if you can treat the mice and vaccinate them and prevent them from carrying the disease, then the ticks don't get it. And then if you don't have infected ticks, you have less infected humans.
How do you vaccinate mice in the wild?
So yeah, you're right. Mice do not line up for vaccines. So what you need to do is you need to put it in food. And they put it in baits that the mice will eat, and they become vaccinated that way.
Dr. Lyndon Hu of Tufts University, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Finally tonight, our Student Reporting Labs team brings us another edition of Moments of Truth, a series examining the spread of misinformation. Tiana Haynes was a college student when she was harassed on an anonymous messaging platform after organizing racial justice protests on her campus. She spoke with student reporter Bridget Aduwadie about how the design of social media platforms can influence online behavior.
It was challenging just knowing that I really could be standing in front of the person who put a cop emoji, a gun emoji, and a monkey emoji and posted it to Yik Yak.
Yik Yak launched a decade ago. It allows people to post anonymous messages within a 5-mile radius, and it became popular on college campuses. In 2015, Tiana Haynes was a student at Colby College in Maine when she was sent hateful and racist messages on Yik Yak.
Before I became a student at Colby, there was an incident where Black and Brown students were actually physically assaulted by security, and we commemorate to say this cannot happen anymore. So I thought, let's try something new by bringing to light some of the injustices that are happening right now in the country. We did a silent protest. We did active protests during the school day in academic buildings, which people didn't like. And that actually started the Yik Yak posts that happened.
On Yik Yak, users could post anything from mundane jokes and random comments to racist, sexist rants. It first appeared in 2013, but was taken down due to diminishing popularity and increased cyberbullying. The app relaunched in 2021 and has recently been acquired by SideChat, another anonymous posting platform.
What was your impression of Yik Yak before everything escalated?
So I didn't really know Yik Yak like that until the incident. I think my friends, they started sharing, you know, look at how they're responding to it on Yik Yak. And for me, I got really sad. It was just really disheartening knowing that the bubble that people felt that it was safe, that this is not that type of place, is actually not true. I think the most nerve-wracking part of everything that happened on Yik Yak was you didn't know who was making those posts. So you might think you're cool with somebody of a different race, right, of a different background, of a different socioeconomic status, but you see a post and you're wondering, is that somebody I just ate food with? Is that someone that I just studied with? Is this directed at me? I was in that protest. Do you feel that same way about me? You don't really know, am I psychologically and physically safe anymore?
What would you say to your younger self back then in regards to this whole situation with Yik Yak and how you handled it?
I would say to my younger self, Tiana, keep going.
Keep going. No regrets.
You'll stand up for your students. You'll stand up for their families and your future job. You'll start seeing how you can still be true to yourself and get what you can out of this life.
To watch all the episodes in our Moments of Truth series, visit studentreportinglabs.org/moments of truth. Also online, how some families are losing food stamp benefits because of prior drug convictions. All that and more is on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Saturday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.